Hi, I'm Josh Becker, the CEO of Lex Machina. Welcome to today's webcast, The Future of Law, Predicting the Behavior of the Courtroom's Boss. This is the third of a series of thought leadership discussions that we are hosting in regular intervals. Today's topic is designed to help you understand how legal analytics can help develop a sense of courtroom expectations for a venue and for potential judges that you may be in front of, including questions such as, what are the predilections of my judge? How long will it take me to get to termination or trial? Should we seek a change of venue? What are the chances of this motion to succeed? Let me start by introducing our panel today. First, fresh off his appearance on CNBC yesterday discussing recent Supreme Court rulings is Mark Lemley, the William H. Newcomb Professor of Law at Stanford Law School and the Director of the Stanford Program in Law, Science, and Technology. Mark is also a founding partner of Dorie Tangri, where he litigates and counsels clients in all areas of intellectual property, antitrust, and internet law. Most importantly, or importantly for us, he's one of the original founders of Lex Machina, and he originally conceived the notion of legal analytics when he started the Stanford Intellectual Property Litigation Clearinghouse, which was later spun out to become Lex Machina. Mark is the author of 7 books, hundreds of articles, and a 2012 empirical study named him the most cited, I believe, and relevant law professor in the country. We also are joined by Josh Curry, who's a partner at Dentons, an AmLaw 100 firm, where he handles patent litigation and other technology disputes, including copyright, trade secret, unfair competition, trademark, and antitrust cases. He has litigated cases in district courts across the country and before the ITC, U.S. Customs Office, and the Federal Circuit. He was a law clerk for Magistrate Judge Elizabeth Timothy of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Florida, and he's authored a number of articles and was selected as a Georgia Rising Star by Super Lawyers magazine in the area of IP litigation for both 2016 and 2017. I want to start out with just a couple of quick slides that we sometimes use to kind of illustrate sort of this notion of how has litigation been practiced in the past, right? What could you know and what you know about judges, attorneys, and parties in your case? Well, oftentimes about the opposing party, you knew nothing. About the judge, you know a little bit, right? So just for example, this judge, you could know where they went to law school, how many years on the bench, said to be plaintiff friendly, which I believe Mark, I think, coined the term anecdata to describe this phenomenon. 89 reported cases, the opposing attorney, where she went to law school, she clerked for a year, had been at this law firm at OrgSafe for 7 years, rumored to play hardball, again, kind of anecdata. And now we fast forward to today, right? What can you know about these parties and the attorney and judge in your case as an example of legal analytics changing the game? And the point is, you can know a lot more, right? A lot more about the opposing party. Took 11 similar cases to trial, won 7, won $13 million in damages, time termination of those cases, et cetera. You can know a lot more about the opposing attorney, has 4 current cases in trial and 3 other filed, so very busy right now. Nervous had a similar case with this kind of subject matter, likes to transfer to a certain district. And importantly for this discussion, right, what can you now know about the judge, right? You can know how many similar cases that he or she has heard, how many times they've ruled for the plaintiff, what's the medium time to trial, what is the percent grant on certain motions like transfer motions, how many, you know, how much damages have been awarded and in what cases, and what, you know, under what theory of damages have they been awarded. So that's kind of an example at a high level. We say, like, you know, how has law been practiced in the past and how, you know, how has that changed with the advent of legal analytics? So with that as a little bit of an introduction, I wanted to sort of turn it over to our panelists here, both Mark and Josh, and kind of ask both of you. So kind of first at a high level, when you're going to appear in front of a judge, right, there's sort of judges you kind of somewhat know, and there's probably things you want to sort of check with data. And then there's judges you really don't know at all, right? Maybe it's an existing client, but in an unfamiliar venue. I'd love if you could both talk about in those cases, in both those cases of types of judges, what are some things you'd like to know? And Josh, maybe we could start with you.
Sure. Thank you, Josh. So, I mean, the ultimate upshot of this is you want to know how the judge is going to rule on issues that are going to be presented in your case. And any information that you can glean on how the judge is going to decide things could be very helpful to you and to your client as you proceed through the court. And as you mentioned, with judges that we're in front of a lot, and I'm a patent litigator, so I'm often in front of judges that hear patent cases, so I know a decent amount about them, but I might not know, how long is it taking them to get a trial right now? How long is it taking them right now to rule on summary judgment? How long is it taking them to get to Markman and to rule on Markman once it's fully briefed, which is a specific type of motion in a patent case? If it's a judge that we're not in front of very often, or that we haven't been in front of in a while, then that obviously gets broadened quite a bit, and you start to look at, how does the judge rule on specific issues that you are likely to present in a case. And just as one example, say in a patent case, especially in software technology, hardware technology, which I deal with often, Alice is a common issue. And so a quick way of understanding, how many Alice motions has this particular judge ruled on and what have the results been? Those would be some things that I would start to look at in a new case for a familiar judge and for an unfamiliar one.
Great. Thank you. That's really helpful. Mark, what about you? What are some things that you would like to check out and know?
Right. Well, so obviously I agree with Josh. What we'd like to know is am I going to win this case? Legal analytics can't get us all the way there yet. But of course, knowing how this judge has ruled in prior cases is going to matter a lot. The other things I want to know how much the case is going to cost, how long it's going to take, right? And there are a bunch of pieces of information that can help point me in that direction. Is this a judge who's likely to stay my case pending a parallel case or a motion at the for an IPR proceeding at the Patent Trial and Appeal Board? Is this a judge who's going to go very early to either a Markman hearing or has a propensity to decide things on pretrial motions, a patentable subject matter dispute at a motion to dismiss and so forth. But even things like, is this a judge who tends to refer a number of subsidiary issues out to magistrates? Right, that can affect both how quickly things will happen, how much attention will get paid to my case, and therefore how much it's going to cost me. Two other things I guess I would note. One is that one of the things I want to know is not just what's this judge's prior experience, but what's this judge's prior experience in relationship with the other side? Have they seen the other side, the other client before, and what happened? Have they seen the other lawyer before, and how often, and what happened? Right? Understanding sort of what relationship this judge has, if any, with opposing counsel may affect what I do in terms of hiring local counsel, how I go in and approach it, how aggressive I am in litigation, and the like. And then the other thing I guess I want to note is that you flagged in your example a judge you know well and a judge you don't really know at all. And obviously, for a judge you don't really know at all, gathering any kind of information is going to be useful, right? It's going to give you more of an insight into what's going to happen in the courtroom. But I want to emphasize the importance of real data, even for judges that you have prior experience with, right? So you mentioned the concept of anecdata. And I think there's a natural human tendency to say, okay, I have two personal data points with this judge, and I can generalize that, and I know what's going to happen in the future, right? And we all do that, right? And it's human nature to do it, but it can really get us into trouble. And so I think one of the real sort of important things about legal analytics for a judge is not just let me find out something about a judge I know nothing about, but let me make sure that my received wisdom based on my personal experience really is representative and not just I happen to have two cases that are outliers in front of this judge.
Well, thanks, Mark. Yeah, I do think you've hit on sort of the crux, right? We all have that tendency to do that, right? To generalize on a couple data points and a couple experience, right? And that's that. In some sense, that is the essence of anecdata, right? And so I was asked recently sort of the mission of legal analytics, or certainly our company, we say to replace anecdata with actual data, right? But I think that's a great point. And Josh, you had also mentioned to me earlier about kind of understanding this judge's experience with your adversary, with the other side. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that as well?
Sure. Well, I think Mark said that specifically, but I mean, that's often something that you want to know as well. And there's useful data out there on lots of platforms, including yours, to understand this. And it's really about distilling that data quickly and sort of getting access to what you need to know, because a lawyer on the other side, as lead counsel, has been in front of this judge dozens of times in a patent case, is someone that you approach, you know, differently than perhaps differently than a lawyer that maybe is new and has never really been there and been in front of that particular judge before. So it's all about the ultimate upshot here is, you know, am I going to win this case or not? And anything that you can get to help guide your decision making as you go in that direction is very useful. And to me, it's about trying to extract that quickly, because I think that's one of the major innovations that's happened with the legal analytics, is that this used to be out there, but it was impossibly difficult to get to. And now we can actually look at it. And then I wanted to also comment on something that Mark said. I think you're calling it anecdata. I think it is right that, you know, oftentimes we think we know Judge Stark and how he's going to approach certain issues, for example, in Delaware in a patent case. But then if you can go look at the actual data, whether it's motions or adversaries or results in cases or timing, and actually see the data to sort of confirm or perhaps dispute, and oftentimes, frankly, I think sometimes what we think might be true turns out not to be after we looked at some of the data, we're in a better position to make a better, more educated decision on what we're going to do in a case. And so that's another thing I think that's probably also very up there on the list of what you are trying to glean and learn from the analytics.
Cool. No, that's great. Thank you. That's really important. And you also mentioned also to me at one point, I think that the importance of accuracy of that adversary, you know, if you're trying to understand the adversary, understanding that the PACER data is often wrong, right? Because especially in Delaware and New York, it's wrong almost, 40 to 50% of the time, because they put on, you know, if because the pro hoc vice issue, for folks that, you know, from large firms appearing in those venues where they don't get listed on the case in PACER, and it's important to be able to understand that. And that's, you know, one of the things I know that we've taken very seriously here with our attorney data engine, to make sure we're providing the right information and actually going in many cases into the signature blocks of cases to see who actually signed it, right? Who actually did the work, and what is the true experience field.
Correct. And I find that to be very useful, because I mean, that's another, it's very obvious, but sometimes you see analytics, and the numbers don't exactly square with your experience. And you dig a little bit deeper and you find out that it's not right for one reason or another. So having the correct attorney names, I know it sounds minor, but it helps a whole lot, because the data is just not as useful if it's not accurate.
Yeah. Good. Agree. Let's talk about a case maybe where you guys have used this. Mark, you had a story you were telling earlier.
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the ways in which this information is useful is at the very outset of a case. Where do I want to bring the case? And we're going to talk obviously about some recent changes in patent law in a minute. But also, do I want to bring a case? And so I'll give one specific example of how we used this information in a way that fundamentally changed our strategy. We're talking to a client who is expecting that they might be sued, having gotten a threat letter in a copyright case. And this is an issue in which it matters what circuit you're in ultimately, because it was a somewhat unsettled legal question. So we had a sort of long conversation about, well, you know what, copyright cases are pretty much all filed either in the Second Circuit or the Ninth Circuit. They come in California or New York. And the Second Circuit and the Ninth Circuit law are both pretty favorable to us, so we think we'll be okay. While we're having this conversation, one of my partners went on Lex Machina, looked up the lawyer, and realized that of the last 15 copyright cases this lawyer had filed, he'd filed 14 of them in Tennessee. And Tennessee, of course, is neither in the Second nor the Ninth Circuit. It's in the Sixth Circuit. And Sixth Circuit law turned out to be a lot less favorable to us. And that totally changed the business strategy, because now the question is not, let's sit back and wait and maybe they'll go away, and if they sue us, we think we're going to be fine. It suddenly became, boy, it's really important to us that we actually file a declaratory judgment case in a jurisdiction where the law is favorable, rather than wait and get sued in a place where it isn't favorable. So I think kind of understanding not just, generally speaking, copyright cases are filed on the coasts, but what does this lawyer do? What happens in this particular courtroom turned out to be critical to deciding what we want to do about that case.
Yep, good. That's a good example. What I wanted to do now is actually run through a couple examples that Josh talked to me about and show you some sort of live walk through them sort of live. So I'll do that now and, you know, ask Mark and Josh to provide any commentary. And, you know, as Mark alluded to, hopefully we'll have a chance in this discussion to talk about recent Supreme Court decisions that are going to certainly impact patent cases and other cases as well. Traditionally, a lot of patent cases, for example, have been in the Eastern District of Texas, but because of these changes, we now may end up in the District of Delaware, a lot more cases. So this might be an example where you want to look and see, and I'm showing the product right here. As you can see, there's data on courts and judges, on counsel, on parties, cases, documents, patents, and then apps, and we'll talk about that in a moment. In this case, I'm looking at U.S. District Court of Delaware cases, and I'm on the judges tab because I want to look at which judges, see the most cases in the District of Delaware, and I can clearly see Judge Stark, Sleet, and Andrews on the top of the list here. And now what I can do is run our courts and judges comparator. So Judge Gilstrap is the judge who had 1,600 new patent cases last year, who we'd often find ourselves in front of in the Eastern District of Texas. But now comparing that judge to these three judges who were the most active I just saw in Delaware, and used to be able to do this manually. Now we have this comparator, so you can just do that and look right away. And what I might do is, I'm just gonna scroll up to the top here, a little biographical information, and I'll just kind of scroll down if there's anything that you guys see interesting, you want me to stop on, let me know. You see a little bit about the kind of volume of cases that they've had, kind of trends over time. You can see the blue line there, Judge Gilstrap.
Right. And also Delaware, which sort of went up in prominence right around after the AIA and then started to decline again as people made the decision that they were all going to the Eastern District of Texas.
Yeah.
That was a decision that stuck until yesterday when the Supreme Court changed the rules on patent venue. And now I think ED Tex is not going to go away, but a lot of cases that were filed there are now going to have to be filed somewhere else.
Yeah. And a lot of those will, I think, be in Delaware, right? So let's, more importantly, and, I think, again, the assumption is that Delaware is more defense friendly. Well, that's, again, where data can come into play and say, is it? One of the things you see here is timing analytics, right? So this is, if you're hoping to get a permanent injunction, the fact that you can't get in front of Judge Gilstrap would be a bit of a bummer now as a plaintiff, right? When you look at these stats, he's granted, he's had more cases reach permanent injunction of anyone other than Judge Stark, but in a much faster.
Do we know if that includes consent decrees? Because boy, those are fast.
Yeah, very fast. Yeah.
And I was going to ask the same question, and then, when you had the time to dismiss statistics up there, I don't know if this is taking out all the ED Texas cases that are essentially NPE cases that settled within the first, say, 3-6 months.
This includes those cases. We will show an example. I can show an example where we can, where you can exclude those kind of high-volume plaintiffs, we call them, which is anyone who's filed more than 10 cases. But this data actually does include them.
One of the other interesting things on the claim construction part of it, kind of challenges at least what I would think of as conventional wisdom, and maybe it's because you're comparing Judge Gilstrap to other districts Well, no, there you have the one with Stark. I mean, I would have thought that Stark would be normally faster than Gilstrap on claim construction. You know, so that's something that I guess it's anecdotal that you all are talking about. And some of that maybe, perhaps that's true. Maybe there's some artifacts that explain why Gilstrap looks to be on average faster and then overall faster than Stark. Maybe it's just the increase in case volume. Things like this also say something to me, at least, about the impact that TC Heartland could have in patent cases, because there may be many, many more cases filed in Delaware where there are fewer judges and, you know, much higher caseload could back these dates up some, which presents some challenges for plaintiffs.
Yeah, and so let's look at Judge Stark. So we dive in. I have Judge Stark here. So here are 1,332 terminated patent cases before Judge Stark. And what I think is interesting here, and Josh, you, I think, pointed this out to me when we were talking earlier, is you look at it, and at first blush, you might say, oh, hey, we're a plaintiff. We're in pretty good shape here. You know, 64 plaintiff wins, only 39 claim defendant wins. Hey, this is a judge we want to be in front of as a plaintiff, and we don't want to be in front of as a defendant. But
yeah, just for context overall, right? Yeah. The overall win rate in the country for patentees across everything is about 25%, right? Mm-hmm. So a 2/3 win rate for patentees is pretty darn favorable.
Yeah, but you might want to say, hey, well, let's exclude those high volume plaintiffs, right? See if that changes anything. Again, high volume plaintiffs being folks who have filed more than 10 cases, and actually doesn't change much, surprisingly. Again, look at that, about a 2/3. Win rate. So you're thinking, again, as a plaintiff, hey, pretty good shape, right? This isn't as bad as, you know, as we thought. Hey, you know, we want to go to trial. But
let me just say something before we move on to that about that high volume plaintiffs tool. I mean, I do think this is important for a variety of reasons. It's important as a kind of understanding the policy dynamics of the system. One of the things that we found once Lex Machina implemented this tool is a lot of the flux in the patent system in the last 10 years has turned out to be really about high volume plaintiffs. Mm-hmm. And things look a lot more even keeled if you take those out. And I do think there's reason to think that a lot of judges and a lot of litigants treat them differently, but also that they're just interested in different things. Mm-hmm. So the ability to say, not just what does this judge do in a patent case, but what does this judge do in a patent case that kind of looks like mine, right? Turns out to be really important.
Yeah, yeah. And along those lines, you might say, okay, well, you know, I don't have a pharma case. And this is why it's important to really understand data. It's one thing to have data at the high level, but it's something to really understand it and be able to dive down, because you, and with a tool like Lex Machina, you can say, you know what, hey, I don't have a, mine is not a pharma case, right? So I'm going to exclude ANDA cases. And then you run the analytics, and now it's very different, right? Now, actually, claim defendants have an advantage when you're looking at Judge Stark. So I think this is an example of really understanding the data and being fluent with the data and not just saying, hey, oh, great, at a high level it looks like this. It's really being able to slice and dice and find a case that's really – or find the data that's, you know, that reflects the case that's most similar to yours, right? Look at the time frame, look at the kind of case. As I think both Mark and Josh said earlier, right, you're trying to get as specific as possible to your kind of case, right? And here's an example where we exclude ANDA cases, and we find out that the story is very different than we might have thought at first blush.
So, Josh, there's one other thing that I see, you know, at least in this, comparing claim, the plaintiff and defendant. So look at the number of defendant cases where there's a summary judgment grant here, which to me, you know, in a patent case where I think I have solid defenses for some reason, this is a good metric to tell me to, you know, look a little bit more at how those summary judgments are coming about, when they're coming about. On the plaintiff side,
zero.
Many of those are trials, you know?
Yeah.
So it's telling an interesting story that, at least before I saw stuff like this, was very hard to get at unless you were local counsel in front of Stark all the time and someone was compiling this kind of stuff for you so that you could actually keep up with it.
Good. And by the way, we'll be taking questions in a moment so that you, for all the viewers, you can type in questions and hopefully you can see how to do that and then we can answer them. So we'll be going to questions in a moment. What I want to do now is just run what I think Josh suggested was run a motion metrics report. And this is a report we developed so to look at a very and look at a high level of some of those steps. So for example, if I was trying to transfer out of this courtroom and see, hey, what percent of those motions have been granted? And you know, I can quickly see, hey, 55% of the time, those motions are granted. Hey, that's very valuable information. And so if I want to now craft one of those motions, I can go into one of the apps. This is in this app section here, and do what we call motion Kickstarter. So I can look at transfer motions in front of Judge Stark. And run Kickstart my motion. And now I can see the last 10 examples of this type that succeeded and the last 10 motions of this type that failed. And so I can, you know, go in and look at, and then you can dive in and you know, down to the document itself, because we have, these are the motion chains, and look and see, hey, what was in this case? Maybe there's some stuff I can reuse or...
Right, and or what were the facts, right? Yeah. If it's all the ones that succeeded had this characteristic, right. You know, plaintiff was out of jurisdiction, right, and all the ones that failed had a different characteristic, then I've got a pretty good idea of what facts will make me more likely to succeed or not.
Well, and that's a, you know, that's an artifact of the motion being venue transfer, right? It's heavily fact dependent. A lot of times, I mean, some judges, to some degree, depending on which party you represent, you may think it kind of skews a little bit, even if the facts should line up in your favor. But this I like a lot because you can quickly get to the briefing on it. You can get this on Pacer, but you can't get it in a very tight segment of the screen very easily and flip through a bunch of them relatively quickly.
And it's not going to be sorted out for you. I mean, you could sort of walk through enough Pacer documents to find all of the times that Judge Stark had a transfer motion briefs in front of him, but you're counting on yourself to make sure you've got it all.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I use this sometimes in a slightly different way. For example, with Alice and Section 101 motions, because you know some judges are viewed as being much less likely to grant those. And so if you can look at those statistics as well and pull similar data. So that's one that's not quite as fact dependent, tells you a lot about who you're probably dealing with.
Yeah, great point. Yeah, and here in a couple of clicks, I can get into these motions. Question that came in, have you any plans or do you already offer this analysis for overseas jurisdictions? And the answer is ultimately, yes. We don't have a time frame on that. I can say with the risk of sort of scooping ourselves, we'll have a bunch of big announcements next month. So stuff we've been working on for very hard now for the last few years to get into commercial law and employment law, obviously two massive areas of the law that I'm sure are relevant to many of the folks here viewing today. You can expect some big announcements next month. But in terms of overseas jurisdictions, that will be down the road. The next question, again, feel free to ask your questions here. Question for Mark. We talked about, you know, mentioned TC Heartland. Maybe you could just tell us for a minute about give people a perspective, maybe if you sort of don't know, about why this is such a significant ruling and what effect it may have.
Sure. So as we learned from Lex Machina data, people had gravitated towards the Eastern District of Texas. Nearly half of all lawsuits in the last 2 years were filed in the Eastern District of Texas, and therefore appeared really before just two judges, Judge Gilstrap and Judge Schrader. What the Supreme Court said yesterday in TC Heartland was that the patent venue statute allowed a defendant to be sued in one of two places where they were incorporated or where they have a regular and established place of business and have committed acts of infringement. So So one of the reasons we started to focus this conversation on Delaware is that so many corporations are incorporated in Delaware that we expect a lot of defendants to be sued there. The judges have experience with patent cases there, and it's easy to find them. But I think the other thing we're likely to see is a scattering of cases from the Eastern District of Texas towards tech centers throughout the country. Mm-hmm. So that Northern California, Central and Southern California, Virginia, Massachusetts, anywhere where tech companies are located are probably going to be growing areas for patent litigation. I don't think that means every case is going to go away from the Eastern District of Texas. There will be some litigation over what it means to have a regular and established place of business, but I think there's a plausible argument that if you're Apple and you have an Apple store in the Eastern District of Texas, and there is currently one in Plano, you are selling infringing products from your regular and established place of business, and so you can be sued there for infringement based on those products. So I think some defendants are going to be sued only where their headquarters are or where they have a manufacturing facility, but defendants that have a large retail presence around the country may still be subject to suit in a lot of different jurisdictions.
Yeah. So we shouldn't be surprised that Apple Store in Plano disappears in the near future.
Right.
Are you going to add trade secret cases under the new Federal Defense Trade Secrets Act? The answer is looking into that. There is still not a separate NOS code right now that I know of, which I think makes it a little more difficult. But thanks for the question. Feel free. By the way, anyone can email me after this, jbecker@lexmachina.com, and happy to get into details on some of those things. jbecker@lexmachina.com. What about another question that just came in? What about from a policy perspective? And I guess we'll give this one to Mark as the academic. If we can start knowing these things about judges, you know, should we measure judges about how they decide things, or how do you sort of see this evolving from a policy perspective?
Well, I mean, I think there are a bunch of interesting facts about this, right? One of the things that this tool allows us to do as a policy matter is identify outliers, right? If there are judges who are ruling for a patentee far more than anyone else in similar situations or far less, that's something that's worth knowing, not just as a litigant. It might be worth knowing as a kind of check on the policy system. Things like how much deference is actually given to magistrate judge decisions. I mean, the district judge is nominally reviewing those de novo, but I think most people would say if a magistrate's written a decision, it's extremely unlikely to be overturned. And then things like we mentioned earlier that the high-volume plaintiffs tool allows you to do, that allows us to sort of understand that what looks like a series of changes to the patent system as a whole is actually two very different patent systems layered on top of each other, one of which is going through a series of changes, and the other of which is actually looking pretty steady. And so I think as we think about do we need or want patent reform in Congress, what kinds of things might we change, understanding those facts, I think, turns out to be really important. And then, you know, you might also sort of figure out if you looked at this that, boy, the District of Delaware probably needs more judges, right? Mm-hmm. And if we were to allocate new federal judgeships in a congressional budget process, one of the things you might look to is how long does it take judges to decide cases? How big is their caseload, right? Are they, in fact, overwhelmed in some districts and compared to others?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just kind of clicking in here around securities cases, which is, you know, another area that we've added recently. You know, there your concentration is more in the Southern District of New York. So, you know, understanding the judges there, right, becomes very it becomes very critical. And you mentioned stays and transfers as well, right? That's areas that you'd want to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. And so in patent cases in particular, one of the major disputes and differences between individual courts is whether they are likely to stay a case pending an administrative revocation challenge in an IPR proceeding in the patent office on the theory that, hey, maybe the patent will be invalidated and it doesn't make any sense to go on litigating it. Most judges, if you bring that stay motion early enough and the IPR proceeding early enough, will stay the case. The Eastern District of Texas has, the data suggests, been an outlier on that question. They've been less likely to stay cases. And so that means that you're going to spend a lot more money, right? Even if you're ultimately successful in the IPR proceeding, litigating and doing discovery in the ED text than you would in another district.
Cool.
Well, and the converse of that is also sometimes true. There are some districts that just grant IPR all the time, or sorry, grant stays pending IPR all the time, and including sometimes before an institution decision. So being able to get that data and to see if your judge is following that trend in that particular district is very, very useful as a strategy consideration for defendants in the case.
Excellent. Well, good. We called this for 30 minutes, but I appreciate people staying a little longer to, and Josh and Mark staying a little longer to answer a few questions. I want to just wrap up and talk about our next webcast. But before I'll turn, any closing thoughts for Josh or Mark?
No, look, I'm obviously biased, but I think this is a spectacular tool that that really does have the promise to change the way litigation gets practiced.
Well, thanks. And, you know, we purposely, I know there's, looking through the list, we have a lot of folks who are not patent attorneys here on here who are commercial or employment and other folks who are looking forward to seeing those modules when we release them. And I can say they'll be happening very soon. So look for, you know, again, people feel free to contact me. And we're excited to be showing you guys legal analytics as well, and we'll be looking forward to showing those trends and seeing what's happening in those areas of the law and shedding some light. The original purpose of this as a public interest project where Mark started is about openness and transparency for the law, and we very much hold that dear, and it's a very much a mission-driven business. Along those lines, you can see Brian Howard, who's our legal data scientist, one of our legal data scientists in-house, has a blog post about TC Heartland using some of our data, and that's going to go up today as well. And you can see that on the lexmachina.com website. So looking forward to seeing Brian's analysis. And believe me, we will be paying very close attention now in the next few months to what's happened, and we'll be rolling out reports about which venues, as the Eastern District, we expect, certainly goes down, which venues are seeing upticks and showing analysis of those judges as well. So thank you all. The next webcast will be on June 27th. We have Yard Tchaikovsky will be joining us, who's a Global Vice Chair of IP at Paul Hastings. And this one is about competitive intelligence. So how do you use legal intelligence? We talked focused on judges for this one, but under the understand the behavior of your clients, of prospects, of competitive counsel, both at the firm and the individual attorney level. So we look forward to you joining on June 27th. And as always, feel free to reach out to me with any questions, jbecker@lexmachina.com, or comments. I want to thank Josh. I want to thank Mark for joining us and for all that you do. And we'll look forward to seeing you all next time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.